Hello and welcome to the Booktopia Buzz podcast for March. I'm Caroline Baum. This month's selection is all about those carpe diem moments, opportunities that can change your life, who you fall in love with, how your work or relationship can take you to unexpected places, what happens when business as usual is interrupted and suddenly everything is up for grabs. Risk, adventure, a stranger walking into your world, just seize the day, or in this case, the book. My book of the month this month is A Mad and Wonderful Thing. Remember that phrase from Jerry Maguire, "You had me at hello"? Well, this book did that. It reeks of Irish charm, but without laying on Irish cliché. Intense and unashamedly passionate and romantic, this is the story of Johnny Donnelly, a young man blessed with charisma and charm, beloved by all who know him. He falls hard for the beautiful Cora Flannery, but keeps a secret from her. In his other life, he's an IRA sniper, shooting British soldiers. When tragedy strikes, Johnny has to choose his loyalties and find a new way to love his country. Written with playful, light and poetic language that embraces music, a proud history, a beloved and wild landscape, and the country's darker torment, the novel shifts mood effortlessly from tragedy to love story, as swiftly as the Irish weather. It tackles the great moral paradox of its central character with deftness and sensitivity, and changes gear, ramping up the drama to an unexpected thriller-like climax. A sparkling debut that celebrates the vitality, resilience, and humanity of Ireland. When it comes to autobiography this month, I picked Making Soapies in Kabul. Aussie women are a pretty gutsy lot, the kind you want in a crisis. There's nothing they won't tackle and take in their stride. Trudy Ann Tierney is the perfect example of that combo of practicality, humour and toughness that is so typical of the national temperament. So when her job, minding a bar in Kabul while the owners take some much-needed R&R, morphs into producing television drama for Afghan viewers, no worries, she's on it. Her staff are inexperienced and her actors can't read, which makes learning their lines awkward. Oh, and she's also delivering subtle public messages about bomb-making, courtesy of her shadowy masters. It does help that she can drink like a fish and appears to thrive in a climate of stress and near-farcical absurdity, prepared to risk her life on hair-raising drives through mine-infested, avalanche-prone country. She tells it like it is, bringing life in kabubble, as it's known to the diplomats, do-gooders and security contractors who fly in and out to get their fix of adrenaline to the page, with raw candour. In American fiction this month, I like The Wives of Los Alamos. When the scientists involved in the Manhattan Project were shipped out to the desert, their wives went too. Not knowing what was awaiting them and unable to tell their families where they were going or for how long. When they got there, their homes were not ready, nothing worked, and they had no resources except each other. The author makes the bold move of narrating the story in the first person plural, we, presenting the women as a group and then fracturing the ensemble off with individual anecdotes about one woman's baby and another's infidelity. It's a brilliant stroke, and despite my initial doubts about how long she could sustain this voice for, it works, suggesting the solidarity of the disparate women marooned in the desert, constrained by secrecy, united in their isolation, and evoking the norms of the Cold War era of convention and propriety. This is a really imaginative treatment of women who've previously been invisible to history, animated with sympathy and insight. Chick Lit is going strong, and this month I picked a new book from Anita Heiss called Tidus. Her feel-good stories about aspirational Indigenous women have been labelled chocolate, which I find obnoxious, even if it's meant to be funny. In her latest likeable and breezy novel, five women, best friends, Tidus actually means friend in Northern Koori, talk to each other about their lives at their book group. They're supposed to be talking about books, but of course they talk about everything but the book. Romance and career dilemmas, baby yearnings, all get aired and shared with laughter and tears over chai lattes and in-between sessions of retail therapy and Bikram yoga. The lifestyle is upwardly mobile, the setting is urban Brisbane, and the women are justifiably proud of their status, earning power and confidence, while never forgetting that their bonds of sisterhood have been passed down through a culture of strong women. In The Wrong Girl, Zoe Foster writes about Lily and her friend Simone. After a few wrong turns, they decide to go on a sabbatical, or man break. Lily needs to focus on her TV production career on a cooking show, but when the new on-camera cook turns out to be a dish, her romantic fasting diet intentions are tested by an unexpected rival. Zoe Foster may have a Miles Franklin winner as a father, who discouraged her from being a writer, but her talent is very much her own. Playful, hip and fun, she has the chick lit thing down pat. Plenty of glamour, social media, goss, casual sex and girlfriend issues. Her ear for dialogue never lets her down, and the likeable freshness of her own profile as part of a media golden couple comes through on the page. This is her moment. Terms and Conditions is a debut novel from a New Zealand writer, and I'm putting it in the satire category. Do you read the fine print? No, thought not. No one does. Well, here's a hilariously sharp satire, a modern-day cautionary tale about what happens when the fine print comes into focus with unforeseen consequences. After his car accident, Frank remembers nothing except that he's a lawyer who specializes in contractual fine print. He does not recognise his briskly efficient and ambitious wife Alice, and he's not sure about his brother Oscar's decision to take the family business into partnership with an arms manufacturer. Footnoted with fine print observations and asides, this is a clever, sure-footed debut, an absurdist romp about second chances that will remind readers the devil is in the detail. Oh, and by the way, Booktopia's John Purcell loves this book and has also raved about it on the blog. So to echo his sentiment, I could just have saved myself the trouble and written what he said. There's another volume of autobiography out this month in the 6-volume epic from Karl Ove Knausgård, the Norwegian writer, whose work goes under the title My Struggle. So I've read volume 1 and I'm halfway through part 2, but I had to skip ahead for this new volume, which is called Boyhood Island and marks the halfway point. Now, maybe it's because I saw him speak last year at Sydney Writers' Festival, and yes, he is a tall and handsome Viking who looks like an older version of Brad Pitt. But what was so memorable was his honesty and vulnerability, his willingness to admit to shame and other socially awkward and traditionally private emotions. For me, he sets a new benchmark for the examined life. The plaudits for this work, as it is gradually translated into English, keep coming. You know you're doing something right when Zadie Smith is a fan. It's sweeping, intense, and incredibly intimate. The third installment is all saturated colour, like an early Kodak snapshot from an old family album. I see a boy running between sandhills on an isolated island in a Norwegian summer. For some reason, I imagine him in a bright red knitted sweater, but that's just me. Knausgård gives us plenty of detail, but also leaves the reader room to fill in the gaps. As a young boy, he's full of curiosity about the world and has that wonderful sense of safety and freedom within his community as he explores its boundaries and discovers what makes him, his family, and his friends tick. He learns to navigate his father's harshness and that not all fathers are alike. The prose is pared back, unadorned, as plain as a stripped pine table, but utterly compelling and addictive. I can't wait for more. In Australian crime fiction this month, there's Beams Falling from PM Newton. Detective New Kelly, known as Ned by her colleagues, is a mess after being shot. But she's out on the streets of Cabramatta working the new Asian crime wave of heroin, home invasions and hits. To the cops, her Vietnamese heritage is an asset, but to her, still damaged and prone to terrifying flashbacks, it's also a burden, freighted with assumptions and expectations. Reeking of authentic insight into the effect of post-traumatic stress, this is gripping and gritty stuff from a writer who spent over a decade as a detective and clearly knows her territory, not only about procedure, but about human psychology. The picture Newton paints ain't pretty and may leave readers wondering why any woman would join the police force. She brings real complexity and compassion to the character of Ned, creating a portrait of isolation, anxiety and conflict that is sometimes uncomfortable to read. It feels so real. Ned is obsessed with a score she needs to settle, but is she sufficiently recovered to make the right decisions and rebuild her life? There's a saying, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. In British fiction, there's a great new psychological novel called Keep Your Friends Close. It's a deliciously nasty story of a marriage wrecked by a best friend turned predator. Natty and Sean run a boutique hotel in the Lake District. She's a type A personality with an obsession with fastidiousness and efficiency and runs her family like a sergeant major. He is all laid-back charm and boyish good looks and wishes his wife made more time for sex. So when Natty is called away urgently and her best friend Eve offers to stay and look after the kids, you know what's going to happen, except that there are plenty more twists to the tale ahead. Crisp as new bedsheets, taut as a fresh facelift, this is a satisfyingly twisted story of malice and havoc. In short stories published this month, we have Abbas El-Zayn's The Secret Maker of the World. This is a collection of thoughtful, often cerebral short stories with a cosmopolitan perspective from a Lebanese writer who now lives in Sydney. His characters are often solitary, a sniper in Beirut, a traveller on a plane musing on fellow passengers, a priest anxious for promotion, a Lord Mayor on a way to deliver a speech. We share their interior lives as fragments of a bigger canvas of humanity on the move, people uprooted, people in transit, both past and present, prose full of nuance and ambiguity. In An Unnecessary Woman, Rabi Alameddine does an extraordinary act of impersonation, conjuring up a woman called Aliya. With her assault rifle at the ready, her hair dyed blue, and surrounded by a prodigious library of books, Aliya lives on her own in a Beirut apartment. From here she considers her city and its maddeningly unreliable electricity supply and chaotic traffic, her family, her noisy neighbours, and above all her lifelong love affair with great writing as a translator of foreign literature. Fierce in her opinions, a survivor of the wars that have ripped her home apart, she's also tart, crabby, vinegary and erudite, an intimidating, formidable combination, but also an inspiring one for her undimmed vitality and solitary resilience. There's a reissue this month of a book that came out last year, a non-fiction book, about the case of Jock Palfreyman, the young Australian boy who is in jail in a prison in Bulgaria. The book's called Every Parent's Nightmare, and author Belinda Hawkins has updated the book with the latest information on the case. You may have seen the Australian Story episode or heard the Radio National documentary about the plight of Jock Palfreyman, who is serving a 20-year jail term in Bulgaria, charged with murder. This new edition of Australian Story producer and senior journalist Belinda Hawkins' excellent book adds updated information about this complex and difficult case. It's a harrowing story that has failed to capture public sympathy and attention until now, but with the Corby case out of the way, Palfreyman deserves greater awareness and action on his behalf. Though motivated by good intentions, his tragedy is that he appears to have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. The most authoritative, independent forensic evidence disputes the charges against him, but he's caught up in a judicial system in a country notorious for endemic corruption and with an indifferent disregard for human rights. Right now, the best outcome would be to get Bulgaria to agree that he should serve out the rest of his sentence in an Australian jail. But for that to happen, the government needs to be persuaded into some discreet back-channel lobbying. For the full selection of my picks this month, you can read the Booktopia Buzz online. Happy reading and see you next month.